Well, good morning. If you'd indulge me for a moment, I'm curious, for a show of hands, who's ever heard a complete sermon series straight through the book of Revelation in your years of church attendance and so on? One, two, three, four, five. Maybe six. It's interesting. I mean, this is a book that often perplexes us, confuses us. It can be kind of overwhelming at times. And I know certainly for me growing up, it was a book I avoided because I just found it too confusing. And I know certainly as a kid growing up in church and so on, I never heard myself a sermon series on the book. And I think that was unfortunate. But I understand how we can be sometimes flummoxed by the book of Revelation. It's full of fire and fury and cosmic scenes and visions and dragons and horses and all sorts of interesting and significant numbers that mean different things in different times. And so perhaps like many of you, I avoided it. But something happened for me. Revelation went from being the book of the Bible that I most neglected to quite honestly being my favorite book of the Bible and my most treasured book. I really love this letter. And the more I read it, the more I'm taken with how rich and sweet and precious it really is. It's really my favorite devotional book. And maybe you find that kind of odd, but it really is that for me. And what happened is I was able to study Revelation for one intense week a few years ago. And I came to realize that this book really is for me. It's God's word through Jesus, through this angel, through John, directly to me and to us as a church. And it's profoundly relevant. Now let me say something at the very outset to allay your fears. My goal in this series is not to be an end times conspiracy theorist. I'm not here to tell you, come hear the secrets of Revelation reveal, that fellowship. No, I want to show how much the hype, actually, and this kind of crazy excitement around the book is actually kind of far from the heart of this letter. I know that's a big part of evangelical church culture, but I'm not really sure it's part of this letter. My aim instead is that we might hear this letter, we would engage it as a people, and we'd learn how to understand it, and then more significantly, obey it. It's meant to be kept. It's meant to change us and shape us. So I want always to be asking, what does Jesus' message to the churches, to the church collectively, and to us specifically, do for us? What does it mean for us? And I want to encourage you to see that this letter is meant to bolster us in our faith. It's meant to bolster our allegiance to Jesus, our King, when other people and other things demand our allegiance. It's meant to bolster our worship of the risen Lord Jesus Christ, the Lion of Judah, and the Lamb who is slain, the one who is coming with the clouds. So my message this morning then is going to give some framework for what's to come. I hope to tackle the book fairly quickly, probably in 12 to 15 messages in the next kind of year or so as I have opportunity to preach a year or two. And the message this morning will be somewhat introductory. It'll be a bit more teaching than preaching, perhaps. But I hope to give you some tools to help you read the book for yourself. And if you go away from here this morning with some degree of ownership on this book, with a sense that this is for you, that you could actually enjoy taking a few hours to read right through it, even out loud, as it encourages us to, then that's the best compliment you can give me this morning. So then with all that said, my message is just seven reasons for why this letter is truly relevant for us today. But before we jump into that, I'd like to pray with you. Father, as Ben has already prayed, we so desperately need your word. We need to hear from our God this morning. Thank you for calling us together this morning before your throne, O Jesus. And we ask now that this time would be used mightily by you to speak to us, to address us, to encourage our faith, because we are your servants, Jesus, and we do want to serve you with passion, with joy, with faithfulness, and with zeal. And so I pray, Jesus, that you would come, that you would minister to us by your Spirit and speak. And I ask it in the mighty name of you, our God, Jesus. Amen. So before we get right into the text, my first reason for why this letter is relevant comes from more of the background of what's going on in the Christians' lives in this letter. And the first reason this letter is relevant today is because this letter comes out of a time where Christians had to compromise their convictions in order to experience the great benefits of the Roman Empire or not, and experience persecution. This letter was originally intended for a group of Christians in Asia Minor, which is in modern-day Turkey. The great issue of the book is that these Christians were tempted to give up their allegiance to Jesus in exchange for their allegiance to the Roman Emperor. The great sin of their day was, quite literally, emperor worship. These Roman emperors set themselves up as gods and demanded homage. They demanded the allegiance of their citizens and even their worship. So for a Christian to say, no, actually Jesus is Lord, not Caesar, was high treason. And it was treason at a time where rulers like Domitian had great political strength to enact judgment. And all this was part of their way of life. And even their work was affected by this. Their trade guilds, they're called. Imagine if tomorrow, for you to renew your license, maybe as a nurse, or for you to take some training in your industry, you had to quite honestly go down to the downtown temple and do some nasty deed to show that you can participate legitimately in society as a worker and as a citizen. That was quite literally what was going on in these days. The worship of the king was connected to the economy and connected to this religious and pagan system. And so then comes this great letter from Jesus, and it's written to unmask the arrogant pretensions of Rome. It's meant to reveal who is really on the throne and to bolster the allegiance of Christians to Jesus, the one who is truly on the throne when everyone else thinks that the emperor is sitting there. It's meant to show that the values of Christ and his kingdom are in direct opposition to the values of Rome and the world. And that, of course, is tremendously relevant for us. We are more and more in this day expected as Christians to compromise our convictions in order to receive the benefits of our society. And if we're not willing to, we won't receive those benefits. I was talking with my younger brother last week on Vancouver Island, and he told me some good friends of he and his wife are trying to adopt a little baby. And in the system, in Victoria at least, they interviewed them for a few months, a few years, and now they're just jammed up in this process of paperwork that they can't get through. And they suspect, quite honestly, it's because the people are asking, what would you do if your little son or daughter came out of the closet? What would you do as a Christian couple if your boy or girl said, I don't believe in your sexual ethic and your approach? And the parents had to say, well, we were Christians. We would teach the Bible. We would do it graciously. We would encourage them in the way that's gracious and godly, but we would uphold the Bible's standard for sexuality. And they're still now just in this bureaucratic process going nowhere, and they've actually given up hope now. And you can see how they could simply just say, oh, well, we'll just do what society says and it'll be fine. But they didn't. And while that's not persecution the same way you might see around the world or in the time of these Christians in Asia Minor, it is still a form of persecution, where someone's goals and dreams for life cannot be worked out without compromise. And Christians in Canada now are going to experience more and more of this. So, we give Sadly, at times we've been tempted to follow through in the demands of our society and to give our allegiance to what we are told by the people around us and by our leaders. Rather than our allegiance to Christ, we give our allegiance to success or entertainment or these hot things of the day, wealth, goals of retirement, sexual immorality. And revelation comes in to say, where is your true loyalty? So this book calls us to honor Jesus as Lord and King when the current social trends of the day tell us not to. And that will always put the church at odds with the world. But here this book gives us this vivid picture of the realities that are behind what we see. This book is all about seeing the unseen. It's about seeing the cosmic forces, about angels and demons, the world behind what we see with our eyes. And we can see ultimately the victory of Christ and those who trust in Him against all other forces of evil. So point number two, which is the first one coming right out of this text. Revelation is relevant because it's a revelation. The word revelation means to uncover or to reveal something. And when the average reader, I think, comes to this book, we generally think, as I said earlier, it's too hard, it's too convoluted, it's too confusing, and it's too challenging. And there must be some hidden mysteries and secrets and so on in this book. But actually, this book is quite simply a revelation. That second word in verse 1, the revelation of Jesus Christ, the word in Greek is apokalypsis. The same word from which we get apocalypse. And apocalypse simply means uncover, unmask something. And so this letter is meant to reveal the truth. It's from Jesus to help us see what's going on. Jesus is telling us how things are going to go. And the purpose of this letter is to open our eyes to see all that Jesus is doing. And that means that even if there are some aspects of this book that are unclear, and there are some, at a fundamental level, we need to have a conviction that this book is meant to be understood. It is sufficiently clear for us to understand and to obey and to keep it. Point three, Revelation is relevant because this is a letter from Jesus Himself. Note that first verse again. The revelation of Jesus Christ. Now that can mean one of two things. Either this is the revelation about Jesus Christ, or it's the revelation from Jesus Christ. And while both of those options are true, I think what this letter intends is the second one. That this is a revelation from Jesus Himself. And verse 1 explains, this came from God through Jesus, who sent an angel to reveal it to John in a vision. And the rest of the first chapter explains more of how that worked. And we'll get into that later, the next message. And I'll also explain next time why I do believe that this was written by John, Jesus' beloved disciple, the same as the author of the Gospel of John. But at any rate, this really is a letter from Jesus for us. And that is amazing. We need to recognize that this is a letter to these seven churches in Asia Minor, but more fundamentally, it is a letter from the risen and ascended Lord Jesus Christ to His universal church in every age. This is for us. And as far as I know, this is the only time really in the New Testament canon where the risen Christ Himself addresses His church on the ground specifically. The red letters are pointed right at you, as it were. This is Jesus speaking directly to us after His church has been constituted after the coming of the Spirit. And that is amazing. And that means this message is precious. It's special. It's unique. Number four, Revelation is relevant because it is meant for the servants of Jesus, that they might know what will happen soon. Over the last few years, it's been shown to me time and time again that for us to serve Christ faithfully, We need to have God's perspective on the future. So there's a word that might be new to some of you, probably not to most of you, but it's the word eschatology. Who's heard of the word eschatology? It's a common word, and I'll probably give this to you and define it in the future. But eschatos is the Greek word for last or end. So eschatology is just the study of the end, the study of things that relate to the end. And the simple point to be made this morning is that everybody has an eschatology. Everyone has certain beliefs about the end. Actually, a couple days ago, I was at work and I was chatting with one of my coworkers about my message. And I said, you know, if you ask anybody, they can tell you a little bit about how they think history is going to play out. Right? Either the world is going to go cold, the universe is going to go cold, or maybe it'll go hot. Okay? Like something is going to happen. And everyone, regardless of your background, has some beliefs about that. And what I want to say is, it is not whether, but which. It is not whether you'll have an eschatology, it is which eschatology will you have. And we live in a day where a lot of our social debates and so on relate to eschatological perspectives. Secular humanists have an eschatology. Other religions, Jewish folks, Muslim folks, Buddhist folks, they all have eschatologies. Our debates currently about the environment or utopian goals for humanity, all of this comes out of an eschatological view. And I happen to think it's just a tragedy that as all of this is happening in our society, a lot of Christians have relegated eschatology to a footnote in their theology. We've pushed it to a side note. But what I want to say is that eschatology is at the heart of everything. It relates to everything, it touches on everything, and it's not inconsequential. So this common idea that we shouldn't study this book or get really into this because it's all just going to work out, so who really cares? I want to encourage you to rethink that if you feel that way. And that's coming out, of course, from this verse, that God has given this revelation to His servants. It is for you. And it is meant to mobilize and fuel your service. And to be very honest with you, it's very clear to me that without a future-oriented vision and perspective, there really is no such thing as leadership. There's no such thing as leadership. Leaders, by definition, are leading people into the future. And so the question is, what future are you leading them into? Is it Jesus' future, the truth, or is it a different vision? And as we go about vision casting, maybe vision casting in your business, casting a vision for your kids, your home, leadership is all about the future. And I could not do what I do without eschatology, without a future perspective. And I think that is so important. So all of you, to certain degrees here and there, are leaders. Whether it's of your family or at your workplace, you're in roles of leadership in varying degrees. And I want to encourage you and commend you to study these matters, knowing that you're leading people into a future. And what future is it? Where is Jesus taking us? Where is He taking you? Where is He taking our church? Where is He taking your business? And to be very frank, if you are quicker to turn to people like Maxwell or Covey or Drucker before you turn to something like the book of Revelation, then something's gone wrong. We need to be intimately acquainted with this book as Christians and as leaders. Now, in this first section, we see very clearly that this is meant for us to get a perspective that is immediate. Jesus is telling us what's going to happen soon. What's going to happen is near. There's this imminency, this immediacy to what's going on. And as you start to just open this book, you get this sense that the future is right on our heels. Like it is right on top of us. It's happening soon. And of course, that raises all these questions because now we're 2,000 years out from the writing of this, right? And that's a big discussion, debate that I don't really want to get into, except for to say that the point in all this is to say that we need to wrestle with the immediacy of all of this. The kingdom of God is near. It's advancing. The pieces are unfolding, and they've been unfolding since this letter was written. And so every day we live is closer to the coming of Christ. He is coming soon. We have to follow Him and trust Him right now because He is on His way. And there's an immediacy that calls us and summons us forward, regardless of how the timing of all this ultimately works out and as the plan unfolds. We need to be, as Christ's servants, motivated by this immediacy and this expectancy. And for those of you who are taking Christ's call to serve Him seriously, and that's many of you, most of you, my prayer is that this series of messages on Revelation would serve to fuel and energize your service to Christ. If that doesn't happen, then I have not done my job. And so, with that being said, also, this is a wonderful time. I want to encourage you in the remaining weeks of August, coming into September, to consider afresh, as your schedule changes, as your routines get solidified, reanalyze your service. How are you serving your King in different aspects of your life? Whether it's outside the church, inside the church, take some time to reflect on that. This is the book of serving, and serving as worship to our King. And if you have time or are looking to serve in different ways, please do talk to us, talk to Jason, myself, others, Russ, Brenda. We're looking for many different roles to be filled in the church even the next few weeks. I might call you. We need ushers. We need children's teachers. We need people who might be willing to put together a driving team for special events, transporting people. We have many needs right now, and building needs, people who would be willing to help on a team to renovate and so on. We'd love to have your help in many different ways. As an aside, but a fundamental aside. Okay, point number five. Revelation is relevant to us because it gives us a series of vivid visions that have immediate application to our lives, our emotions, our imaginations, and our choices. The single most repeated verb in this book is behold. Behold. Look. See. This is a highly visual book. And that is because we need to realize John, he's just simply recording all that he is seeing, one vision after the next, as this angel leads him and shows him. John is sort of in this visionary state as he's receiving these images and these symbols. And that's also, of course, what makes this book so challenging at times, right? We need to come to this book understanding that it is a very symbolic book. These images are rich and in symbolism, and you need to be careful not to push all of the details of the symbols so that they're literally true in every single way. That's not how they're meant to be understood. And for example, Jesus is described right there in the first chapter as having a sword coming out of his mouth. Now, does Jesus have a literal sword coming out of his mouth? Well, no. But what is that meant to say? Well, Jesus has powerful speech. His words are piercing. His words are piercing in their judgment. They're piercing in their power. They're strong. And so we need to grasp the meaning behind the symbol. That's how Revelation is really built. And to help explain this, Ruth is going to bring up a little symbolism for us. Symbolism you know. I love Alberta beef. All right, so what do these symbols mean? It means buy more beef, eat more beef, support the beef industry, something I'm a fond believer in, okay? But, okay, imagine with me, okay, 2,000 years from now, this PhD student comes up, excavates an F-150 with this on the bumper sticker, and he starts to analyze it, and he analyzes all the details, and he thinks, oh, okay, what could this possibly mean? Okay, only 1 in 4 people have a real heart. I love bullseye barbecue sauce. That was a thing that was prevalent back then. Maybe that's what that means. Maybe I is the Roman numeral 1. So this is a sequence of things playing out. And okay, anyway, you understand what I'm doing. The symbols of Revelation, they were grasped by the original audience. They were grasped quickly, just as quickly as you saw it and you understood, okay, this is beef, right? I know what this is talking about, buy beef. And in the immediate context in Asia Minor, these Christians would have just, they would have got the symbol fairly quickly, fairly readily. And in fact, this kind of symbolic genre of writing was fairly prevalent in that day. It's kind of hard for us now, like we don't get our heads around this, but think of the book of Daniel, for example. There's these visions in the book of Daniel. Daniel sort of set the precedent for other writings that came from about 200 years before Christ to 100 years after, where people were writing these sorts of highly visual, highly stylized writings. And I'm not trying to say that they were inspired or whatever, or that Revelation is just like any other document. It's different. It has significant differences from those writings, but there's overlap in the style. And that style, what I'm saying, would have been understood by a lot of those original readers. Okay, so you might wonder, why all these images? Why all this visual stuff? Why all the symbolism? Why not just say it really plainly? Like, Jesus is coming back. Things are going to get really bad with this emperor. Why not be more just totally straightforward? Like a letter from Paul, for example, right? This just simple. And I'd like to suggest that Revelation is meant to grip us. These pictures, they're meant to grab our emotions, our affections, our imaginations. It's the difference, for example, between reading a manual on your car and understanding your engine and then sitting behind the wheel and watching things as they come. When I was growing up, I got the chance to go with one of my dad's friends, and we drove in this ragtop with the top down out to Tofino with the wind in our hair and the sun beating down and the beautiful smell of the ocean and just this beautiful day. Now, if you just handed me a car manual, here's a ragtop, here's how you understand it. Like, it would not, there's a difference, right? It's meant to grip us. It's meant to give us this kind of deep hope that goes down into our hearts and our bones. And that's the point of the symbolism and the imagery. Okay, now this is a part of the sermon that's going to be a little bit more heady, but I hope it'll bless you and help you. So I want to share the four main ways that people have understood the imagery of Revelation. For all the writing that Christians have done for millennia now, all of it can kind of be lumped into four main ways that people have approached this book. And for me, it was tremendously helpful just to get some perspective on that, and I hope it will be for you as we just lay some framework to go into things. So point number one, we have it on the next couple slides here. Perhaps the most academic way of looking at the symbolism of Revelation is through an approach that is called preterism. Preterism. Preterism comes from the Latin word praeter, which means past. So preterism is very simply pastism, and preterists just argue that these symbols you find in Revelation, the horsemen, the women, and so forth, those are all just relating to events that are now in our past. And they would even say that maybe 90 to 95% of what is in this book in terms of visual stuff is in our past, with maybe a little bit in our future, like the return of Christ and so on, a little bit in the future. If you think all that's in the past, then you're outside of Christian orthodoxy. It's an issue, but very few would hold that. Most preterists would say most of it's in the past, but there's a future component. I like preterism a lot. I think there's a lot going for it. In fact, I think every Christian should, to a certain degree, be a preterist. And the clearest reason is because when Jesus looked at the temple and the disciples said, "When is this being destroyed?" He said, it's going to happen soon, and we all know that it's destroyed. And that's preterism. It's past. That's fulfilled prophecy in our past. And then, of course, Jesus extrapolates into the future, and so it's not, you can't be a full preterist. But some of us, well, we all, should feel that way a little bit. Partial preterism. And I think that's helpful as we come to the book. I think to understand the connections between emperors like Nero or Domitian as it relates to some of the images of this book is helpful. But I also think it falls short. And where I think preterism deeply falls short is that it tends to take the cataclysmic, over-the-top language of Revelation and funnel it into these very kind of simple events. Right? Like, fire is falling from the sky and hailstones are, like, it's crazy. And you're saying all that relates to the period of 70 AD where the temple fell and the Jews were at war with Rome and all that. And there's clearly something bigger going on. Okay, so that's the shortcoming of it. The second way people have come to look at Revelation and the images of it is through what's known as the historicist approach. The historicist approach. Some of you might be aware that different Protestant confessions, for example, have called the Roman Catholic Church the beast and the Pope the Antichrist. You've maybe come into that before. Well, that kind of way of thinking is motivated by a historicist approach to Revelation. The historicist comes to the images of these books and looks over the vast sweep of human history and says, this image relates to this time and this beast relates to this church. And they look at the grand narrative of history and apply the images successively. So some people might be interested to know that some have argued the black horse. Those who know about this black horse that comes, they think that was a famine under Emperor Galerius. So some people connect these images in a very clear way to different centuries of human history. The weakness of that approach is that nobody really agrees on the details. Like, how much certainty can you really have that the Pope is the Antichrist? Like, maybe an Antichrist, but the Antichrist? How can you have that much confidence in the certainty of the events? And really, we need to be aware that in every phase of history, Christians have read their own circumstances into this book. And that's true also of the historicist approach. On the flip side, there's something that we should learn from this approach too. Clearly, Revelation encompasses all of history. We want to affirm that. The problem is when we try to be super specific in all the details. I think that approach comes up short. The third view is that of idealism, the idealist approach. And the idealist approach says that essentially all these images are allegories. They're all just, in the very basic sense, meant to teach us timeless principles of Christian life. They're allegorical. And so they might have multiple fulfillments from generation to generation. They're very straightforward. I have a friend in Lethbridge who holds to this, and he's a great guy. He says, Mark, all of these visions, these are all just pictures of what Christ has achieved on the cross. That's really all it is. And of course, we kind of want to affirm that. Like, there's something to that, for sure. But on the other hand, the problem with the idealist approach is that there's a lot of chronological markers through Revelation. There's a lot of progression in time. There's things that are growing and moving. And if you take all of that momentum and progression and chronology and just shrink it into pictures, it doesn't really do justice to the progressive nature of the book. And so I think that we do need to learn from this idealist approach, but there's also better ways of looking at some of these things. Okay, the fourth view is that of, well, it's the view you all know the best, futurism. Futurist view, and this has become very popular these days in books and movies and so on. Futurism, as an approach, says all of the images, all the visions, at least from chapter 4 and onwards, are all in our future. They're all one day going to come, and then they're going to come fairly rapidly. Generally, this view has a great emphasis on the literal meaning of each vision. They believe that the stars will fall from the sky quite literally. They believe that the details of every vision essentially have a one-to-one correspondence with human events and history in the future. So, for example, the mark of the beast is like a literal stamp of the beast, or like a chip that's implanted. You've maybe come across that idea. Many futurists in the past have argued that there are literally 144,000 people saved. That's kind of a futurist thing, like this intense, detail-oriented approach. And we know, actually, that a rigid literalism is simply not the way this type of writing works. And the way you can know that is from the first chapter, because we'll get into this in the next time, but Jesus is very clear that the lampstands represent churches. Right? There's actually a clear connection through these symbols. They're not meant to be pressed in all their detail. And same with the numbers. The numbers in this book are symbolic. Numbers like 7 suggest the divine, God. Numbers like multiples of 10 suggest completeness and fullness and so on. So they're not meant to be pressed in all their details. And one of the main weaknesses of this futurist approach is really that it doesn't make sense to the Christians to whom this letter was originally written, right? You have to put yourself in the shoes of a Christian in Asia Minor, and if you're reading this letter, and how would you arrive thinking that, okay, the Russians are here, and Trump is here, and it's meant to be understood to these original recipients, and we need to remember that. With all that being said, I still think there's legitimacy to the futurist approach. I think to a certain degree we have to be futurists. The coming of Christ is in Revelation, that's future. So there's something to that as well. So now you've heard me speak critically and positively of all these four approaches. And you're thinking that's not very helpful. And then you have my approach, which is the right one. So we'll bring up the next slide. I'm joking, but Marty Cooley was a prof of mine at Briarcrest, and he really helped me because he took this approach. And he says, the key to understanding Revelation is you have all of these images, right? There's tons of them. And the key to understand it is to recognize that before it is visual and apocalyptic and cataclysmic and all that, it is first and foremost a letter. This is a letter written to real people, to real Christians. And so we need to always ask, how do the images and symbols fit into the real lives of the Christians in Asia Minor? And this question is going to be at the back of our minds this entire study. I'm going to completely hammer it over and over. How does this fit into the real lives of the Christians in Asia Minor? Because the more we can grasp that, the more we can draw the connection for our lives and put it all together in a way that I think interacts with these top four in ways that are nuanced and helpful and hopefully edifying to you. So then, a helpful quote from Dr. Robert Mounce. He says, the events relating to the Roman Empire of John's day were a model of the ultimate collapse of all worldly opposition to the kingdom of God. The task of the contemporary interpreter is to read the symbols in the vocabulary of their first century and then to interpret them for the 21st century in terms of their final and complete fulfillment. So we need to continually ask, what did this mean to them? What was going on for them politically and in their society? How did they read the Old Testament? And how are images from the Old Testament coming up for them in the book of Revelation? How do these images connect to books like Daniel and Ezekiel and Exodus? And the more we can think these ways, the more helpful it will be as we put it all together. Cool, 15 minutes left. Two more points and we're good. And these last two are quick. They're quick. Okay, that was the heady part. Okay, point number 6. Revelation is relevant because it gives an immediate blessing to all who read it out loud. Verse 3 says that those who read aloud this prophecy will be blessed. And let me ask you a simple question. Have you gotten to verse 3 yet? And did you go on to read the whole thing aloud? Did you open your mouth at that point? I did that once. A few years back, I was sitting in my room reading Revelation. I was like, oh, well, I guess I could take the afternoon off. And I read it aloud. And maybe it's That's one way of obeying that. You could also read it with your wife or husband. You could read it a chapter at a time with a family. And you will be blessed because we will be reading it as a church successively aloud together. And I think that's just wonderful. It's meant to be proclaimed. It's meant to be heard. It's meant to be put out there. And then we'll expound it and learn how to experience and obey it together. Point number 7, and this is the final point. On top of all of this, revelation is relevant because it is meant to be obeyed. It is meant to be obeyed. Verse 3 says that those who are blessed are not just the ones who read it out loud, but those who hear it and keep it or obey it. That is really my heart in this series, is that we would learn to truly keep this word. If we neglect this great letter, we neglect obedience to our King. This book truly does shape and fashion us into a people of obedience and a people of hope and faithfulness and courage and worship. That's at the heart of this letter. It is written to heighten our hope as we seek to try to make sense of some of this and put it together. The vividness of this book lifts our eyes to Christ and the hope we have in Him. He's coming. The plan is unfolding. You can be a man or a woman or a boy or a girl of hope and not be driven by fear and anxiety when you turn on the news. Revelation summons us as well to gospel faithfulness. This book, at the fundamental level, is about being a bold witness to Jesus day in and day out. It's about faithfulness. And the faithfulness of a life that speaks and demonstrates the glory of Christ and His saving work on the cross for us and for all who would trust in Him. That's at the heart of this letter. Revelation also summons us to courage. Courage to stand for Christ in a godless culture. Courage is so needed today in the church. We have failed to really highlight the importance of courage. We've highlighted gentleness as a virtue, and rightly so, but courage we've neglected. Courage is needed. Courage is necessary, especially in our days, and especially in a world that's trying to mark you and mark you with its priorities and its values. We need to be marked by Christ, and part of that means having the courage to stand for Him in a world and with its values that are perishing. And revelation, perhaps above all of this, this is why I love this book, it calls us to passionate and fervent worship. Worship of our risen King. Worship of Jesus, the Lion and the Lamb. The one who's coming on the clouds. The one who we exalt. The one whom we love. It calls us to worship of the triune God. God, the Alpha, the Omega, as we were singing earlier, the Everlasting One. He's our God whom we worship. The Spirit, the Holy Spirit, is at the heart of the work of this book, and we're called to worship Him and Jesus. Fundamentally, this book is so Christocentric. It is all about Jesus. From the first to the last page, this is a book all about the worship of Christ, the one who is coming to wipe away every tear from our eyes and to make all things new. And we need to learn what it means to worship. Worship as service, worship in our lives day in and day out, in our deeds, and then the kind of exuberant praise and fervent glorying in Jesus that bubbles over on a day like today, on a Sunday. That's what this beautiful book is about. It's about worship. It's about courage. It's about gospel faithfulness. It's about hope. And it's about Christ. And it is a glorious book. It is a sweet, sweet book. It is precious to me. And I trust that in the coming months, it will become more and more precious to you.